Hello, welcome to Discursion with your usual host Stephen and
Dominic.
We've had a brief Christmas break, but now we're back ready to talk film. Today we're looking at Jacques Tourneur's Out of the Past, quintessential film noir from 1947. Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer, Kirk Douglas, all good people.
Absolutely. As usual, we're not going to avoid spoilers, so sort of turn away now if you don't want to have the film spoiled. We should give the usual attempt at, well, I won't attempt a full plot summary because I think that would be beyond me.
Oh, that makes me feel better that you said that, actually, because there are a number of twists and turns in the film that make it quite difficult to give a succinct recap.
Absolutely. And I feel it kind of, I don't know, do you have this experience? It almost feels like in its sort of second half or its latter third, it almost sort of runs away with you. So it gets more complicated than you've been led to expect up to that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like the double crossings come thick and fast towards the end of the film.
Yes.
Jane Greer's role in particular is... it's quite dastardly, and she's quite difficult to keep up with.
Right, absolutely, yes. It's all about who thinks, who people think they are, and who they think other people are, and who they think other people think they are. So these, yes, complicated, reflexive
yes.
interpretations, which everybody is doing, rightly or wrongly, throughout the film, often wrongly.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, just to give, yes, to give some kind of bearings before we get into more details. So we meet fairly early on. We meet Jeff Bailey, played by Robert Mitchum, and his sort of blonde all-American girlfriend, and the first major part of the narrative is told in flashback, as is actually the Jeff Bailey character's sort of monologue, I suppose, or you know, represents the story that he's telling to Anne about his past. Not his. It's sort of something that happened kind of three or more years before. So it's not, which in some ways I find slightly surprising. You know, it's not the long distant past. There's some disconnection between the actual length of calendar time and this fact that this is, or he wants this to be another life, which he wants to have escaped. And this involves that he's been hired, well, he's formerly a private detective and is hired by Whit Sterling, played by Kirk Douglas, with a fair amount of relish, I think it's...
Yes.
I think it's fair to say, to find Whit's girlfriend, who is the Jane Greer character, Kathy Moffat, who has shot Whit four times, one of which, they say something like, she made one of them good. So anyway, he's been seriously hurt, but not actually killed. And supposedly she's run off with a large amount of money. And Mitchum goes off. He tracks down Kathy in Acapulco. They decide not to... he decides not to bring her back to Whit and to run off together. But this all goes wrong. Well, they sort of live sort of undercover for a while, but then get rather cocky with themselves, and then get spotted by the Mitchum character's former partner, you know, his detective partner
Fisher,
and then they get tracked down. There's a fight, and then Kathy shoots Fisher. So at this point, I suppose, from Mitchum's point of view, her true colours have been revealed. He learns that at this point that it is true that she did steal the $40,000, which she's insisted that she didn't. And he apparently has up to this point believed her. So this is all the flashback. And then at this point, we sort of return to the present day, as it were. Mitchum goes in to meet Whit again, and is told an elaborate story, which I think we see right from the outset. He is not entirely entirely convinced by. But Whit basically wants him to help him get out of the possibility of going to jail for tax fraud, and so wants him to get some papers from a particular lawyer, at which point we learn, yeah, that that Kathy has in fact come back to Whit. She emerges from the background of the shot in a kind of, yeah, sort of dramatic but unmarked a kind of way.
Out of the past.
Exactly. Is that enough plot summary?
I think so, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty much a sort of last man or last woman standing
yes, true.
Race to the bottom, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm interested because this film, because I sort of, even though I don't feel capable of confidently giving a coherent plot summary, I feel I know this film rather well, and it's one of my it's one of my favourite film noirs, but it's one of my yeah, the films I'm fondest of in general. But I think it was a newer one to you.
It was. I don't have a past with Out of the Past, really. We don't have a shared history. I watched it for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and this is my third viewing.
So how did it? Yeah, how did it strike you on first or second viewing?
First viewing, I was quite surprised by the start of the film because I was aware that I was watching a classic example of film noir. So I was surprised by that setting and by the tone, and then I was increasingly confused by the plot. Mm-hmm. The first time around, as often when you know you watch a film for the first time, you pay attention to story, I think, over anything else. It's not the case with all films, but with Hollywood films, I think that's the case.
Yeah, this way that the complexity starts, or the confusingness starts to run away from you. I feel this is one of the distinctive things of the film, because there are other noirs we might be able to think of where it's, I mean, The Big Sleep would be the famous example, where I think the confusingness of the plot is established so early that either it loses you or you're quite quickly, I think, sort of put into a mode of watching where, at least certainly on an early viewing, where you kind of recognise that it's not going to be worth trying to keep all these details in your head and kind of trusting the film's confusion is part of its effect, you know, or you'll just enjoy the wisecracking dialogue and the cinematography and you know Humphrey Bogart kind of sparring with Lauren Bacall, yeah, etc. Whereas this film, I feel the fact that we get into that territory more gradually makes it perhaps all the more disorientating, or at least, yeah, certainly has a quite different effect. I think it's one of the things that is really quite interesting with this film, where you have to think about how it offsets some of the cliches of noir. So, for example, you know, having mentioned wisecracking dialogue, again, it's a little different in this. It's not like Raymond Chandler, is it?
Characters don't often say what they mean. I mean, you can, there's often the sort of talking out the side of one's mouth, and there's a slyness to the dialogue which is quite not noirish, I suppose. There's the you could translate a number of the lines into plain English, you know, and they would be much less interesting, much less beguiling.
I mean, it certainly has the sort of dry, sort of fatalistic, but also quite enjoyable, I mean, kind of dialogue. It's often, it is quite funny in places. But it doesn't have that, it's not as flashy as that sort of Raymond Chandler kind of dialogue. You know, I mean, that line that, I don't know if this is in any of the adaptations, and I forget actually which novel it comes from, but the thing about I'm not going to be quoting this entirely accurately, but there's a line to the effect that she's the kind of broad who would make a bishop kick a hole in a stained glass window. Now, that's not a line I can imagine in Out of the Past at all.
Yeah, you can still tell that Out of the Past has been written by a novelist, I think, but a lot of the comebacks, I suppose, are quite slick and quite quick. And there's not over elaborate description usually. Often the characters will dance around words or just slightly change the meaning of words. For example, when I think it's either Joe or Whit, probably Whit, asks Jeff if he can listen, and Jeff says, I can hear. I'm present, but I won't be necessarily receptive to what you're saying.
I mean, that's quite an important sort of thematic, or something that runs through the entire film, is these sort of motifs of listening, hearing, speaking. It's almost made sort of explicit right at the beginning of the film. There's a conversation between this character Jim and the woman who runs the kind of cafe, which is all about, I mean, it's all about, she says what she sees, and Jim says, are you sure you don't see what you hear? So there's ideas of kind of gossip, and but it's have you read the Robert Pippin's chapter on this film? I haven't read a great deal on this film, but yeah, yes, Robert Pippin's book about film noir, the first film that he covers in detail, is out of the past, and yeah, I think it's well worth reading. It's very interesting, but he describes it almost as a, you know, sort of surprisingly kind of abstract set of propositions about exactly how seeing and hearing and saying might be related, and you know what might be a sort of truthful way of them being related or not. So yeah, so it's, I think that's almost something which the film makes explicit.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the minor character you just mentioned in the cafe is almost, she's like a, I think of her as a sort of Thelma Ritter type, you know, very
yes,
straight talking, and well, says what she sees, perhaps, or perhaps not. And later on,
I think that story's interesting. Yes, I think that. No, I think it's interesting. I mean, sort of imagining her being a Thelma Ritter character. I feel she's, if this isn't too convoluted, I almost feel that perhaps she thinks she's a Thelma Ritter kind of character.
She has that. She thinks she has a backbone, but maybe she doesn't have that kind of.
Yes, she thinks that she perceives accurately and she says what she sees, but precisely what's raised is perhaps whether...
I know what you mean.
You know, whether in fact she's not...
Yeah. There's a slight need to be heard.
Should we say more about the performances? Because there's a bunch of very striking performances in the film, aren't there?
Yeah. Well, the performances are, and the roles are to some extent signalled by the names. I mean, Kirk Douglas's character is called Whit, and he's almost like the whittled end of a sharp stick. He's very, very pointed, both in his sort of appearance and his sort of slick back hairstyle, and in his comebacks, and in his sort of fierceness, you know, his sort of ferocity. And then we find out Jeff's real name is, what is it, Markman?
Markham.
Markham.
Yes.
He's almost like a, I suppose, a marksman. I mean, he's someone who can hunt people down.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
So what do we do with Kathy Moffat?
I'm not quite sure what we would do with that one.
Like Little Miss Moffat. I'm not sure. Yes.
Maybe it's gendered that the men have very
possibly
strong. Fisher is more of an obvious one.
Yes. Well, there's a whole thing running through the film about fishing.
Of course.
When we first meet Jeff and Anne, they're fishing, and he's saying the fish aren't biting, and there's later on a character gets in fact killed by being caught by the end of a fishing rod and pulled off a cliff into the river. I mean, Mitchum's excellent, isn't he?
Yeah.
Again, on sort of understatement.
Yes. There's also thinking about the characters as being rounded, as being complex. There's a kind of tiredness about Mitchum, which makes me think of Bogart. And interestingly, Bogart was supposed to be the lead for this film, the preferred lead, but Warner Brothers wouldn't release him to RKO.
Right.
But anyway, there's a kind of...
Wasn't it not offered to a few people?
It was offered around, yeah. But I think the novelist preferred Bogart above all.
Right,
other.
But
there's a kind of tiredness about Mitchum, which almost suggests that he's tired of playing this role, you know, that he can be quick talking and he can go on these jobs, but he, at the end of the day, he sort of wants to settle down and move to the country and go fishing.
Yes, absolutely. But interestingly, yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, but one might automatically think that that was also a sort of reflexive thing, but in fact, you know, about the roles which Mitchum had played. But in fact, at this point, Mitchum hadn't played a great deal of roles like this, I don't think. I think this was one of the ones which, you know, set him up. Which, in a related point, not about him, I find it really interesting. I mean, isn't this... I think this is Kirk Douglas's second or third film. Like, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, which I believe is his first film, I think that's 46.
Hmm.
But it strikes me that he gets a star sort of entrance in this. The camera pans across and he's in the sort of middle distance, but it's like very... I can't watch it without, you know, without feeling very much, right, here's Kirk Douglas, that's important. You know, it's a star. It feels to me as a star performance. But then I can't help but be... I'm watching that, having seen all the Kirk Douglas which came afterwards. So it can't have been seen like that at the time.
But that it almost seems that these characters have that kind of weight, that they have that history behind them is interesting. That Kirk is foregrounded as a star in that way.
Yeah. I mean, do you kind of agree? It does feel like I'm not quite sure how I would argue for the case, but it just feels like he's handled, like his sort of the way the character is introduced. It almost feels like he's given more of a star entrance than Mitchum is.
Remind me what his entrance is.
They've been sort of... He's been talked about, and he's been talked, you know, because he's been talked about between Jeff and Joe, you know, and so we know something about his power and how he's someone that you can't escape his grasp if he wants you back, you know. So it's kind of set up that he's somebody powerful and impressive and dangerous who we might sort of want to see. And then, yeah, I mean, I think the camera, so then, as I said, I think that, you know, the camera just kind of pans across and there he is sat at a desk. But even that kind of quietness, and it's not a kind of dramatic close up, that in itself, I don't know.
It just usually, when you introduce a star, I mean, you can do it in a number of ways. You can have them front and center from the start of the film. Usually, I think the noirs tend to sort of ease in a bit more, and sort of you wind your way through to the main cast. But I suppose you could also have a late entry. That's a good way of foregrounding your star character, to build up to them. And also, if they are stars, you can rely on shared knowledge, really, that the audience knows what they're getting. And you don't have to be very direct about the character's traits or about the package at all, you know, because it comes with the star. It's all built in.
So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some case of, you know, you can have, it can be a star entrance even if someone isn't at that point an incredibly famous actor, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, there's some recognition that this is a way that you can treat this actor that will work, even if, I mean, clearly he wasn't unknown, but he certainly didn't have the status he would have had even, I don't know, 5 years later or, you know.
I think he was on loan from Paramount, because he wasn't an RKO star.
Right.
And he was with Paramount for some years.
Right.
So they are almost treating him like a special guest.
And then Jane Greer, we should talk about Jane Greer, who also gives another excellent performance, I think.
Yeah.
When you're familiar with the film and you have got a handle on the plot, then I think it is possible to work out fair, you know, with a fair degree of consistency when she's lying. In the experience of the film, it's not at all clear. I mean, I don't know if it, to some extent, puts us in, obviously, Mitchum's position, who sort of, you know, doesn't want to think she's lying for quite a lot of the film, simply because he's fallen in love with her.
She's given a big star entry, isn't she? I mean, it's a funny one. She's in Acapulco, and he's waiting in... I wouldn't say it's a dive, but it's a small bar, and she literally walks out of the cinema almost. I mean, cinema is in the background, isn't she? Isn't it, when she walks into
That's
the
true.
Anyway.
Well, and there's also the point. So she's both, it's a connection between cinema and also dream, because he makes the point that it's hot, it's the middle of the day, he's drinking beer, he's sleepy. So she, again, almost literally
materializes,
walks in out of a dream, you know, you stepped out of a dream as the, It struck me also, watching it this time, something I hadn't noticed previously. She, there are kind of 3 points where her sort of entrance is particularly remarked upon by the voiceover, by the Mitchum character. And the first time that you just mentioned, she comes in out of the sunlight, whatever it says. Then when he meets her a couple of days later at a bar, she walks in out of the moonlight. And again, this is literally spoken. And then when they meet up, having been sort of lying low separately for a while, just before she ends up shooting Fisher, she appears in the car headlights.
Walking up the road.
Yeah, I remember. So there's sort of explicit, I wouldn't quite go so far as to say it's sort of, you know, in drawing attention to its cinematic status and the way that the characters are lit, but it's at least it's made explicit that she appears in different forms of natural and artificial light.
Silhouetted or in a kind of half light. Mm. Yeah.
There's some trajectory towards the, I don't know, is there a sort of trajectory towards the more artificial? I mean, like you say, when we first see her, she does, in a sense, both sort of step out of the cinema and out of the dream, but she is in broad daylight, you know. And then it's moonlight, which is easier to see things that aren't there, you know. And then it's a headlight, so it's not even it's not even natural light. She's, you know. Yeah, the artificiality.
I suppose to support the argument, they do end up going to San Francisco, and there you're in more traditional noir territory. At least it's a city, and it's dark, and they're on the streets.
At that point, they're sort of safe while they stay in the shadows, aren't they? That's the sort of thing. They while they're keeping to sort of more disreputable haunts and staying out of the daylight, they're safe.
Apparently this film had some problems with the code, and Joseph Breen wasn't very happy with the fact that Kathy's character seemed to be living with both Wit and Jeff at the same time. And so Jeff's living situation in San Francisco is kept deliberately sort of vague.
Right. Talking about light and things, we should talk about some of its visual qualities. Nicholas Musaraka is the cinematographer,
a bit of a collaborator, was he, with Jacques?
Exactly, yes, and sort of known, you know, those earlier RKO Val Lewton, you know, produced, Jacques Tourneur directed, sort of, you know, B horror movies. You know, things that are now very well known and highly regarded, like Cat People. You know, he was the cinematographer on that as well. But again, this is another of these things where I think this film sort of interestingly, you know, just slightly sort of sidesteps some of the conventions, or is helpful in sort of thinking about them in a slightly more nuanced way, because, you know, these cliches that you still hear about noir, and sometimes I think from commentators who should know better, is this idea of making the best of not having a great deal of money, you know, and so, you know, shooting things with incredibly high contrast because you could, you know, if you left great areas of the shot in blackness, you couldn't see that it was unbelievably cheap and, you know, whatever. And of course, of certain films, that kind of thing is true. But with this, I mean, RKO wasn't by any means. It seems to have been a studio that was in financial trouble for its entire existence, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
But as far as budgets go, as far as I know, this is not a B movie. It's not the most expensive A movie compared to what, say, yeah, Warner Brothers would have been spending on a film. But it wasn't cheap. I mean, there's a lot more location, you know, shooting on location than you might expect from this period. I think even in some more expensive films.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the surprising elements of the film, that it is so airy.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, yes, yeah, that's...
Something quite blatant about actually deciding to shoot a noir in Mexico in that harsh kind of sunlight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Well, of course, we could say the same thing that people always say is, of course, that they can't have known that they were shooting a noir because the term hadn't actually been invented. So whatever they thought they were shooting, they at least couldn't have called it a film noir. Still, yeah, you don't normally start your tense, you know, detective thrillers in sumptuous landscape. It has those things which, again, are the sort of standard visual qualities one could say with, you know, dramatic shadows and dramatic angles of shooting, but like by no means consistently throughout the whole film, right? It has quite a broad range of visual repertoire, don't you think?
Yeah, it's almost surprising when Robert Mitchum discovers Kirk Douglas shot dead on the floor, and the camera suddenly dollies towards him in that revelation. Because often in that space, in that mansion in the hills, the shots tend to be more like a tableau. I think a lot of the dialogue is shot straight, for want of a better word. Usually the film isn't, I don't think, foregrounding those devices.
No, exactly. It's quite, I think one can make a case it's all quite classical, isn't it? I mean, if one of the cases has been made is that noir somehow sort of subverts a certain idea of a classical visual style, which is sort of at the service of its effects and not intended to draw attention to itself, you know, whereas perhaps, you know, noir films are commonly thought to, or a certain number of noir films do make much more sort of explicit reference to their own, you know, visual qualities. Yeah, with this film, it does feel that, or it feels to me that it's, although it's visually striking, that's very much at the service of the narrative or of, you know, the emotional qualities. It's remarked on in the film about, by Jeff, among others, about how rapidly Kathy is happy to switch sides. But there's also the moment which, again, I keep mentioning the Robert Pippin piece on this, but he has an interesting discussion of this. The scene in the office of the manager of the club, which Witt owns, but where Witt is not present, so various people are deciding, you know, Jeff at this point has the upper hand and has Witt's incriminating tax papers, so there's sparring going on as to who will come out on top, because no one wants Witt to find out that they have lost his papers. Jeff lies to protect Kathy, and then about 10 seconds later drops her in it. Mm. You know, there's like, because he's asked how he knew that the papers were in this office, and in fact it's because Kathy told him, and she kind of shoots him an imploring glance, and he says, oh, it's because I had his secretary tailed. Mm. So he tells a lie that has no motivation other than to protect Kathy. Mm. But then, yeah, sort of a couple of lines of dialogue later, he has the opportunity to, you know, deny that Kathy had done something else equally incriminating, and he just says, sorry, baby, or something. So that's quite psychologically interesting, but also kind of narratively confusing, or also psychologically confusing. You know, why has he just given up? In those few seconds, he's realised he doesn't want to make the effort to protect her.
It almost comes back to the idea of fatigue again.
Right.
He's basically framed for this. The idea is that he's going to retrieve some papers from Eels, who, again, has a very interesting choice of name given the slippery situation.
Well, absolutely. And Eels, yes, Eels is murdered, and we feel sort of sympathy for him, but he's also a blackmailer. So
yeah, it's about exasperation almost with the whole the idea of being framed, and oh, isn't this sort of tiring that they think I'm this stupid that I would go along with this, and I will for a little while, but then I'll just sort of relax into it and almost have a bit of little bit of fun with it.
Maybe I have a excessively, what would the word be, Pippinian reading of this film, but I think
suitably convoluted.
Yes. So one of the things that film noirs explore, or certain film noirs explore interestingly, is that we don't find out who we are by sort of introspection, by just sort of you know sitting down in a quiet room and kind of looking inside ourselves. We find out who we are by what we actually do. Whereas in a more kind of classical film, even though we've said this film has perhaps to some extent more classical elements than we might think, or at least visually, but a more classically constructed narrative, it would seem very strange that he would defend Kathy and then refuse to defend her sort of immediately. That might seem like an incoherent character. Or we could look at this, like you said. I mean, I think it's interesting. We could say, okay, is there some plan that he has which does make those moments coherent, that he's sort of choosing, he could be tormenting her, right? So yes, he chooses to protect her and then doesn't. But yeah, I think it does play in this idea of exhaustion, that something just happens that he just stops wanting to, you know. Perhaps he finds something out about himself. I don't know what that would be. He doesn't have time to, you know, reflect on that and put that in words. Good. Yes.
We should probably do a little endy bitty. I'm trying to remember what we've had such a break. I'm trying to remember what the endy bitty sounds like. Thank you for listening to our discussion. It's been fun.
Yes, it has been fun.
Please like and subscribe. We are on Podbean, iTunes, and also now Spotify.
And we'll be back in the not too distant future with an as yet undetermined film.